talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor. Grow up to be a hero and a scholar.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away, across the waves he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the train. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain.
Well, the word got around and said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you wait.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Kagan. Tonight's show is on the man, the myth and the musical as we explore the life and legacy of one of America's most influential founders, Alexander Hamilton. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Born in the West Indies, Alexander Hamilton rose from obscurity to become George Washington's trusted aide during the American War of Independence and then the first Treasury Secretary of the new United States. From his fierce rivalry with Thomas Jefferson to his tragic death in a duel with Aaron Burr in 1804, Hamilton's life was filled with drama. One of the least well-known of the founding generation, probably because he never became president, Hamilton became a global icon following the success of Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical on his life and legacy, a production which has now come to Ireland. And so to help explore his life and his legacy, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Robert Watson is Distinguished Professor of American History at Lynn University in Florida, an expert on Hamilton's early life, his contributions to the Revolutionary War, and his time as Secretary of the Treasury. He is the author of George Washington's Final Battle, The Epic Struggle to Build a Capital City and a Nation, and Alexander Hamilton, Adultery and Apology, Observations on Certain Documents in the History of the United States for the year 1796. We're also delighted to be joined by Dr. Grace Mallon, Career Development Fellow in History at Lady Margaret Hall at the University of Oxford, an expert on America's founding era. She has explored Hamilton's influence on the federal government and his vision for the nation's future. And you're both very welcome to the show. Robert, I might begin with you and a question about the success of the musical Hamilton, because I have that sense that Alexander Hamilton was one of the less celebrated of the founding generation. But then since the success of the musical, he's suddenly been catapulted to this center stage.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So unlike other founders like George Washington and John Adams, he didn't go on to be president. Unlike the celebrated founder Thomas Jefferson, he didn't write the Declaration of Independence. Everybody knows Ben Franklin, the so-called quote-unquote first American. But Hamilton was just as important as all of those other founders. If we could take a time machine and go back to 1789, the time of the Constitutional Convention, you would find that Hamilton was just as well-known and just as celebrated among other people. He was the hero of the Revolutionary War. He was George Washington's right-hand man, as they say in the musical, first Secretary of the Treasury, an important framer in Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention of 1789, and so on. But He did fall out of favor. Of course, the fact that he's killed in a duel doesn't help, but he did fall out of favor in part because of that, in part because of his enemies. But this musical absolutely resuscitated Hamilton's long-forgotten reputation.
And I've seen it in New York. I'm going to see it now again when it's in Dublin. It is absolutely brilliant, the songs, the energy on stage and the drama of it. But it does take liberties and it does maybe blend certain things together. And the fact that you do have a multiracial cast is wonderful, but it perhaps brushes over some of the complexities of the issues.
It does. I've seen the musical several times. I put together a curriculum guide for school kids, so I used it as a vehicle to teach students about the Constitution and founding of the United States, and I train teachers and so on, give lectures at theaters. So I've seen it many times, and basically I've fact-checked it. You're right. It does take some liberties, but there are a lot of accuracies. A lot of the portrayals, the sequence of events. I don't have a problem with the liberties in the musical. Heck, any play, any opera, any novel, any movie does take liberties. But you know, it's largely spot on. There are a few things. There's one of the duels in the musical does portray Hamilton and Burr as sort of the seconds in the duel, and it sort of that helps for the dramatic effect of setting them up against one another. The Schuylers, it shows three sisters that were available for Hamilton. Well, the third, Peggy, was far too young, and there were more sisters than that, actually. And so it does take a few liberties. But, you know, I don't have a problem with that. And also the colorblind casting, because I've gone around to universities and high schools all around the United States, and I find that the students love the show. It engages them. So as in the story and anything that brings history to life for young folks, you know, count me in.
No, count me in as well. Grace, what about you, your feelings about the musical and how it portrays some of these crucial issues?
I echo Robert in most respects. You know, I really loved the musical. I think one of the things I really love about it is that the way that it brings a lot of these founding era texts to life, because they're actually quoted, you know, they're worked into the dialogue. Many of the actual texts. I think one of my favorite moments is definitely the rap battle over the National Bank, because it kind of actually replicates in some ways what happened. You know, this sense of like, I'm gonna, you know, Washington is getting an opinion from Hamilton, and then he's getting an opinion from Jefferson and Madison, and then, you know, he's coming back. So, you know, I really appreciated many aspects of it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you could have been anywhere in the world tonight, but you're here with us in New York City. Are you ready for a cabinet meeting, huh? The issue on the table: Secretary Hamilton's plan to assume state debt and establish a national bank. Secretary Jefferson, you have the floor, sir.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We fought for these ideals, we shouldn't settle for less. These are wise words, enterprising men quote them. Don't act surprised, you guys, cause I wrote them. Ow, but Hamilton forgets. His plan would have the government assume state debts. Now place your bets as to who that benefits. The very seat of government where Hamilton sits.
Not true.
Ooh, if the shoe fits, wear it. If New York's in debt, why should Virginia bear it? Our debts are paid, I'm afraid. Don't tax the South, cause we got it made in the shade. In Virginia, we plant seeds in the ground. We create, you just wanna move our money around. This financial plan is an outrageous demand, and it's too many damn pages for any man to understand. Stand with me in the land of the free. Pray to God we never see Hamilton's candidacy. Look, when Britain taxed our tea, we got frisky. Imagine what gon' happen when you try to tax our whiskey.
Thank you, Secretary Jefferson. Secretary Hamilton, your response.
Thomas, that was a real nice declaration. Welcome to the present, we're running a real nation. Would you like to join us? Or stay mellow doing whatever the hell it is you do in Monticello? If we assume the debts the union gets, a new line of credit, a financial diuretic, how do you not get it? If we're aggressive and competitive, the union gets a boost. You'd rather give it a sedative? A civics lesson from a slave, or hey neighbor, your debts are paid cause you don't pay for labor. We plant seeds in the South, we create, they keep ranting. We know who's really doing the planting.
I think there is this really interesting question of what does the colorblind casting kind of do for audiences. And I think, you know, there are some really positive aspects to it for some people, because it makes some people who maybe might feel excluded from American society, or from particularly the halls of power that are being portrayed in the musical, they actually feel engaged. They feel like they're part of American history. They feel like there's a place for them in this founding era history, which is really positive. At the same time, of course, we do have this issue of, you know, was Hamilton as much of sort of a fighter for liberty, and particularly the liberty of enslaved people and people of color, as he's portrayed to be in the musical? So that is one issue that obviously has come up again and again in discussions of the musical.
And yeah, and that is one of the challenges, because watching it and the casting, you do think, okay, he's this great champion of freedom, he's against slavery, but it perhaps overemphasizes it more than perhaps the evidence is there to suggest.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's an ongoing debate about how involved Hamilton was with slavery. It was obviously, it was quite fashionable at the time for some people in Hamilton's social position to be members of manumission or abolition societies, as many of the people that Robert just mentioned, many of the founding fathers were. There's also a question about, was Hamilton engaged in slave trading, in the sale of enslaved people? Did he own slaves? And, you know, it was in New York at the time where he lived, there were sort of tens of, you know, I think there was something like 20,000 enslaved people living in New York state in 1790. So, you know, slavery was sort of a part of his day to day. You know, does the musical brush over that a little bit?
Robert, let's talk about the rise of Alexander Hamilton, because the musical very much portrays him as this scrappy upstart who rises from nothing, from poverty, from obscurity, and through sheer hard work and force of effort and individual genius, he rises to become, well, the right-hand man of George Washington during the War of Independence, and this genius, this influential writer who shapes and reshapes the early United States. How much of that is rooted in the truth?
I think a lot of it is. I'm fine with the portrayal of him as quote-unquote young, scrappy, and hungry as they rap in the musical. I agree with what Dr. Grace was just saying thoroughly, and I do love the rap battle back and forth, as well as there's other ones over neutrality. Should the U.S. get involved in Britain and England's ongoing feud, or should it remain neutral? There were a number of cases where Hamilton and Jefferson, the two leading cabinet officers, really squared off. And I thought the musical does a good job of portraying that. I also agree that Hamilton's legacy regarding slavery is more complicated. Nonetheless, he did get involved and was a founding force with the New York Society for Manumission. And if there was some slave trading, he was a teenager working as a clerk, basically, with a Dutch shipping operation that did potentially trade in slaves. So we can't really hold that against him. But yeah, young, scrappy, and hungry, no question. First off, his mother dies when he's a child. There's a yellow fever pandemic, which is reflected in the musical. And it does wipe out, it's estimated, maybe half the population throughout this ordeal. So Hamilton is orphaned. His biological father, James Hamilton of Scotland, abandons the family. Hamilton and his brother James are left alone. He grows up in Nevis and St. Croix, and both islands at the time, you know, Nevis was 6 by 9 miles long, both of small place. Both islands were overrun with periodic diseases, hurricanes, the horrors of slavery, piracy. There were pirates in the downtown, I mean, like a movie or something. So this is the kind of upbringing Hamilton had. He manages in 1773, the year of the Boston Tea Party, to find his way to America, manages to go to King's College, which is today Columbia, joins the Revolutionary War effort. He's brought to the attention of George Washington through acts of absolute heroism on the battlefield. So yeah, it is really a rags to riches kind of a story. And I do think the musical at least in the opening rap, does reflect that to some extent.
And he does have that incredible career then during the American War of Independence. He sees action on numerous occasions. That's shown in the musical as well. Some crucial friends there, including the Marquis de Lafayette, including with Hercules Mulligan. And then comes to the attention of George Washington, who needs an aide who is going to be able to ensure that his instructions and orders are carried out. And he does play a very important role there with Washington as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And those characters, John Lawrence and Hercules Mulligan and Marquis de Lafayette, were real characters, and Hamilton was friends with them. They did work together during the war. All of them played a part in it. So, and George Washington even referred to folks like Hamilton and Marquis de Lafayette as, quote unquote, my military family. And they saw him as a father figure. Washington always wanted a son. The loyal, wonderful son, and he never had a son. He never had children of his own. So in that respect, Hamilton does fulfill that kind of son-like role, and he does serve with heroism during the war. The musical brings out the Battle of Yorktown, which was in September and October of 1781, which is really a pivotal turning point in the war where Washington finally gets the big victory he needed, in this case over Lord Cornwallis, and captures thousands of British soldiers. So this is really a turning point. It would end up being about the last major battle of the war. And Hamilton is at the forefront in winning that battle. So that projects him to fame throughout the colonies, now states.
And Robert, what was the relationship with Washington like in this period? Because Hamilton does seem anxious for combat. He seems anxious for glory. He wants a commission and he wants to fight, and rather than playing this crucial role behind the scenes. And he makes sure that in those final months, he does get back out onto the battlefield.
Yeah, the musical does portray that accurately. Hamilton, like a lot of young men, was eager for glory. He wanted combat. He was too important to Washington. Not only did Washington see him as the son he never had, but remember, Hamilton's writing Washington speeches. He's handling his correspondence. During the war, you've got Lafayette, Rochambeau, and the French. You've got Baron von Steuben, the Prussians, and others. And Hamilton speaks a number of languages, so he's almost a translator interpreter for Washington. So he's too valuable, but Hamilton is itching to fight. He does have a horse shot out from under him at the Battle of Monmouth, which he distinguished himself there. But yeah, during Yorktown, he's really itching to get back to fight. And he takes a momentary leave from the war. His wife gave birth, and he is brought back for the Battle of Yorktown, where he leads the final charge, which overruns the British positions. So therefore, he gets the kind of battlefield glory that he had always sought and always, yearned for.
Grace, what about the 1780s then, when the war has been won, the Americans are working out how to build this new country? He returns to civilian life, he returns to this legal career, and he also gets involved in some of those early discussions about what kind of country should be created.
Yes, the 1780s, the aftermath of the Revolutionary War, is often talked about as the critical period in the founding era of American history, because there is this question, you know, we've won the war, but what do we do now? Is sort of the question that's dominating a lot of these sort of influential young men's minds in the period, sort of after the Treaty of Paris in 1783. And in sort of the lead up to the Constitutional Convention. And Hamilton becomes an important member of a group that we often refer to as sort of nationalists, which is to say the United States is made up of different states, which each have their own government. And the states have sort of been in the ascendant in terms of making important policy decisions about how to run civilian life in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War, during the Revolutionary War and in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War. And Hamilton is keen to make Congress, the sort of central governing organization, more powerful, because he thinks the states aren't doing a very good job of running the United States. And he thinks that partly because the public credit, the sort of finances of the United States and of the individual states in the 1780s after the Revolutionary War are in a pretty dicey position. there is a real sort of likelihood that the United States is going to end up defaulting on some of its debts, which it's accrued by borrowing money during to sort of finance its war against Great Britain. And Hamilton is trying to think about how to remedy that situation. And one of the solutions that he's in favor of is strengthening the central government, is strengthening Congress and creating a new central government, which will be able to handle the financial affairs of the union better than the individual states can.
And that seems to be the big debate of that time, whether you'll have a strong national government or strong states. And he's very much on the side of a strong centralized national government.
That's exactly right. Yes. And, you know, I think one of the interesting things, again, coming back to the musical, is obviously the musical is about the birth of America and sort of American identity and sort of pride in American identity. But one of the interesting aspects of this period, particularly for Hamilton, is that, you know, some Americans are saying, well, look, the British Empire had its problems, right? We just fought a war to get out of it. But there are aspects of the way that the British did things that we might like to try to replicate because, look, they're pretty powerful, they're pretty influential. So Hamilton is actually someone who kind of admires certain aspects of the way that British government is run and wants to replicate them. And one of the ways he wants to do that is to create this stronger central government, which will have the upper hand over the individual states.
And some of his ideas aren't taken on board. For example, his idea that you would elect a president, but that they would serve for life, and perhaps the same with the senators as well. And some of these create a suspicion that he's a bit too fond of the British system of monarchy, and these aren't taken on board.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, and I think this is something that comes out in the musical, you know, he is a member of the Constitutional Convention, which meets in Philadelphia in 1787. And he, you know, he is involved and he puts forward a plan, sort of a plan for what the new constitution could look like and how the new government could be organized. But exactly, I mean, a lot of his plans go down in flames without a lot of debate because he's seen as being too extremely in favor of replicating aspects of the British system in a way that isn't popular in the United States at a time when obviously sort of a more democratic understanding of government is really at the core of a lot of Americans' visions for what they want their country to look like, which, you know, some states have produced radically democratic constitutions. Pennsylvania has a unicameral legislature. It, rather than having a single president or a single governor, it has a group of executive officials. It has sort of a multiple executive. And Hamilton is coming back and saying, no, we don't want that. We want to have, as you say, something that looks a little bit like a House of Lords in the Senate. We want to have a president who can exercise power with the same energy, is the word that he likes to use, the same energy as the king.
And Robert, so he's not the creator of the Constitution, but he certainly is instrumental and plays a hugely significant role in defending it and in persuading people to accept it. And he does it through these Federalist Papers, and he's involved with John Jay and James Madison in writing them, but he writes a considerable number, and you see so much of the Hamilton genius in terms of the energy, in terms of the ideas, in terms of the way he can argue and present ideas in these papers.
Absolutely. Yes. So as Grace said, you know, they were in a serious debate about the role of the federal government. And, you know, we didn't have public opinion polls back then, thank goodness. But in reading the founders, you get the sense that Hamilton's positions were in the minority. He was a voice in the wilderness. But he does, through being so vocal, his relationship to Washington and so persistent, he does play a major role in getting the amount of power that the nascent republic does have, than the government does have. But his chance comes through the Federalist Papers. New York is hesitant to ratify the Constitution. And George Washington is about to be sworn in 1789 in New York. So he has the quandary, how am I going to be sworn in to the interim capital city of New York? Washington, D.C. didn't exist at the time. How am I going to be sworn in when they haven't even ratified it? So Hamilton's giving the task to educate the public and ratify, get New York to ratify. And he uses this opportunity in the Federalist Papers for much more than just that. And yeah, he writes the majority of them. He writes 51. One of the things that Hamilton deserves credit for is he works with James Madison, who's basically of the opposite political faction and wanting less government. Madison's from the South. Hamilton's in the North. Madison writes 29, and they also wrote with John Jay, who wrote just a handful before he becomes ill. But, yeah, Hamilton uses the Federalist Papers to really educate the public about what the framers' vision for the United States was, and it works. And New York ratifies the Constitution, and these papers have become a keen insight into the debates that the framers had that Grace talked about a moment ago.
The United States comes into existence then, Grace. George Washington becomes the first president of the United States, and Alexander Hamilton becomes the first Secretary of the Treasury. And talk to me about his role in that office and how he helps, I suppose, create the financial, the economic structures for this new country.
Yeah, I mean, Hamilton, you know, besides being this great soldier, besides being this figurehead of the revolution, then becomes one of the key architects of the United States government. And as you've mentioned, he's appointed to be Secretary of the Treasury. And he has a number of interlinked plans for how to restore the nation's finances after sort of the devastation of the Revolutionary War, which we sometimes call the Hamiltonian program. And, you know, part of that is he's going to implement a system where the United States government is able to collect its own taxes, which sounds like funny, you know, couldn't the United States government collect its own taxes before then? But no, I mean, before the Constitution came into effect in 1789, Congress essentially had to ask the state governments to give it money. So the states would have to collect the money, collect the taxes, and then they would have to essentially give it to Congress kind of almost voluntarily, which didn't work out very well. The states were not keen to give away money to Congress. So the United States needs to create its own independent system for financing its government. And so Hamilton is in charge of implementing that. So how he decides he's going to do it and how Congress decides to do it is by creating a system of customs duties. So they're going to make most, the United States is going to make most of its money as a government from collecting customs duties on imported goods from Europe, especially in other places. Hamilton also decides that he wants to create a national bank, which, as we've mentioned, is sort of very controversial. There's a lot of people who don't like that idea. But one of the things he wants to do with that national bank is to get buy-in from the wealthiest, most influential members of American society at the time. He wants to put them on the board of the national bank and give them a sense that they're really going to be involved in the future of the United States. And he also does something called the United States government assumes the debts of the states, which they've accrued throughout the Revolutionary War, which again is a very sort of controversial aspect of the Hamiltonian program. And, you know, he makes a lot of enemies during that process. But he also plays this crucial role in actually getting the United States out of its financial hole and giving the United States government the power to actually effect its own laws and become a functioning government.
Robert, I want to ask you about the relationship with Thomas Jefferson, who became Washington's Secretary of State, the first Secretary of State in the United States. And there always seems to be this tension between Jefferson and Hamilton. It comes to a head perhaps after the 1800 election, but they very much seem to have different conceptions of what America should be and how the United States should operate. And they always seem to be on different sides of the crucial arguments.
Absolutely. And in so many ways, and one way, political factions, we would say parties today, begin to emerge. And Hamilton leads the one faction. We call them the Federalists. And Jefferson leads the other faction, the Anti-Federalists. And they were on opposite sides of all these issues on the bank and assuming the debt. Hamilton was on one side, Jefferson on the other, on neutrality in terms of the war and between Britain and France. They're on opposite sides, pretty much everything. Moreover, they were opposite people. Jefferson was from the South, was a slaver. Hamilton moved to New York and had more progressive views on the issue of slavery. Hamilton was loud and outspoken. Jefferson was quiet and reserved. Jefferson was old money, one might say. Hamilton is new money, or, you know, up from nothing. So they were very different people, and they didn't like one another. That dislike was mostly coming from Jefferson. Jefferson, for all of his remarkable traits, he was very thin-skinned. He was prickly, could be very prissy about things. And Jefferson did not like people to disagree with him. And Hamilton, of course, never holds his fire. So they didn't really care for one another. And there were a few other issues where they really squared off. One was on this notion of implied powers. You know, even today, as we look at the U.S. Supreme Court in the United States and what is the role of government, conservatives tend to have this view of originalism and strict constructionism. Basically, if it doesn't say so in the Constitution, it doesn't exist. And Democrats, liberals, have the view of implied powers. The Constitution implies certain things. Hamilton is really the architect of the notion of implied powers, as George Washington is trying to figure out what to do about treaties and other issues. He looks at the Constitution, and quite frankly, it says nothing. So when George Washington finds himself in a quandary, he doesn't know what the role of the president should be and how much he can act or not act, because the Constitution is vague on purpose. He asks Hamilton to look into it. Hamilton produces a voluminous legal brief, which basically develops the idea of implied powers. So lo and behold, as we've been discussing this debate about a stronger national government versus state governments versus the power of the feds versus Hamilton, kind of develops his own argument all along for a stronger federal government through his notion of implied powers. And of course, Jefferson's on the opposite side. And at one point, Jefferson is so frustrated with Hamilton, because whenever the two of them argue, it seems like Washington backs Hamilton the lion's share of the time. Not only did Washington agree with Hamilton ideologically and philosophically more than he agreed with Jefferson, but Hamilton is almost like Washington's adopted son. So Jefferson is so upset, he resigns from the administration and starts planning his own run for the presidency. So, yeah, there was no love lost between the two of them.
No love lost between the two of them. Well, speaking of love, Robert, can you talk about the tangled love affairs then of Alexander Hamilton? Because he gets involved in a major scandal in 1797, the Reynolds affair, and he publishes a lengthy defense of his actions to show that there was no financial corruption or skullduggery involved. But it means exposing and admitting to this affair and being blackmailed and so on. And it is a major scandal and controversy in that time.
The Reynolds Pamphlet. Have you read this?
Alexander Hamilton had a torrid affair, and he wrote it down right there.
Highlights!
The charge against me is a connection with one James Reynolds. For purposes of improper speculation, my real crime is an amorous connection with his wife for a considerable time with his knowing consent. I had frequent meetings with her, most of them at my own house.
At his own house.
At his own house.
Mrs. Hamilton, with our children being absent on a visit to her father.
No. Have you read this?
Well, he never gonna be president now.
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 That's one less thing to worry about. That's one less thing to worry about.
Yes, it's probably the biggest scandal in the early republic's history. Hamilton, I always say about Hamilton that he's easy to love, but he's hard to like. He could be abrupt. He could be aggressive. And he had a number of dalliances with women that are, you know, hard to ignore in terms of the historical record. Hamilton was an extremely charismatic person. He was extremely handsome. And, you know, part of that and his eagerness to do everything led to his demise. So Maria Reynolds shows up on Hamilton's door. Hamilton opens a law firm in New York City. Hamilton's wife, Eliza, takes the children back to Albany, which was normal to get out of the city for time back home. And Hamilton starts a romantic fling with Maria Reynolds. Unbeknownst to him, her husband, a scoundrel of an individual, is using this to blackmail Hamilton for bribery. Hamilton does accept the blackmail by paying off Maria Reynolds' husband. And we have documents that point to this from a number of folks. At any rate, so Jefferson and company, Hamilton's enemies, and there were many enemies of Hamilton, claim that he used public money to pay this. And Hamilton, perhaps foolishly, writes this huge admission of guilt. But the argument is, I did have this affair, I did pay her, but I didn't use public money. And it quite appears that he didn't, but he basically admits to the affair. This would not have been as big of an issue for someone else, but this is the Secretary of the Treasury who has developed the bank and overseeing the country's finances, gets us out of debt. This is Washington's right-hand man, his advisor. And, of course, Hamilton had made so many enemies that his many, many critics used this opportunity to pounce. And this is part of his, absolutely part of his demise.
Do you think he had bad judgment, Robert, that sometimes when you have times like that, which requires a cool head and perhaps to work out what are the different options and pick the one that's going to cause the least amount of damage, that he kind of rushes into things sometimes without really thinking it through?
Absolutely. I agree with that. Hamilton did not have a lot of sound judgment on a lot of issues. Was he brilliant? You bet. Was he brave on the battlefield? You bet. Was he invaluable to the founding of the country and his fingerprints all over the country? Yes, you bet. But he was rash. Hamilton, you know, one thinks if he was elected president, of course, you have the native-born clause on Article 2 of the Constitution to be the president, but none of them were born in the U.S. The U.S. didn't exist. But Hamilton would have been a bad president. He was a rash. So in some ways, the same things that made him so effective, this bold personality of his aggression, his confidence, it made him so impressive on the battlefield. It made him such an invaluable aide. He could think out of the box. But his virtue was also his vice.
His virtue was also his vice. And Grace, what would be your sense of the character of Alexander Hamilton? Would you admire him or do you think he's a deeply flawed figure?
I have a lot of time for Hamilton. I think Robert's characterization is excellent in the sense that, you know, Hamilton was brilliant. And he, I think, you know, one of the reasons he's at odds with Jefferson is because there are aspects, I mean, there are things that Hamilton understands about governance that Jefferson maybe doesn't. I mean, something that we sometimes talk about in looking at the early American Republic is the fact that, you know, Americans were afraid of a lot of sort of contemporary methods of governance, like having banks and various kinds of financial schemes to sort of keep the country's finances afloat. And Hamilton really got all of that. And, you know, he was very well read. He was reading Adam Smith. He was thinking a lot about how to sort of take the United States forward on the global stage. You know, that's one of the reasons he was at odds with people like Jefferson. But as Robert mentions, the other reason is I always think, you know, Hamilton liked to wind people up. That's something that I get, you know, reading his voice in some of these records, particularly at places like the New York Ratifying Convention when they're debating whether to ratify the Constitution. He's really trying to antagonize some of the people that he's debating. He's not interested in making friends. And I think that's exactly right. That's why he was kind of a bad leader for the Federalist Party in other ways. You know, he was very ideologically committed, but he wasn't really all that interested in making friends if it meant that he had to compromise his convictions at all.
Well, we are tonight talking about Alexander Hamilton, the man, the myth and the musical. And we'll continue this exploration right after this. Well, welcome back as we look at the life and legacy and indeed the legend of Alexander Hamilton. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel, Professor Robert Watson, Distinguished Professor of American History at Lynn University in Florida, and Dr. Grace Mallon, who's Career Development Fellow in History at Lady Margaret Hall at the University of Oxford. Well, welcome back. And Robert, can we talk then about the 1800 presidential election? Because it's a confusing election because there are votes cast in the Electoral College for both the presidential and the vice presidential candidates, and you have Jefferson and Aaron Burr, who's his running mate, are tied. So it goes to the House of Representatives. And Alexander Hamilton then, certainly in the musical, plays a role in making sure that it goes to the presidential candidate and not the running mate.
Yeah, the 1800 election is absolutely fascinating. And it was chaotic. Remember, the country's brand new, and they're still trying to get their feet, their legging, if you will, in how to make elections work. And the framers came up with this bizarre thing called an electoral college, whereby each state gets a certain number of electors. The public votes in November, and then in December, the electors go to state capitals and cast their votes. So it's an odd system. And we need to remember that back then, previous to 1804, so in the 1800 election, the president and vice president ran separately, basically. And they would say, well, whomever won gets to be president, second place would be vice president, not as a ticket like today. So it was a three-way race with Jefferson and Adams. Adams was the sitting president, Jefferson the sitting vice president, which is also interesting. And the two of them had been friends and opponents, which makes it even more interesting. And then Aaron Burr is in the equation. And no one saw this one coming. Jefferson and Burr tied 73-73 in that election. And there were less states, so less electoral votes. So they had to have a tiebreaker, which went to the states. Now, this is November of 1800, December, January, February. Over the period of basically 4 months, there's 35 tied ballots in terms of the tiebreaker. No one can get a majority to become the president. One of the reasons was we were so partisan, not unlike our politics today. It was dysfunctional. It was partisan. There were also threats being made of everyone. If you were to flip your vote, you might lose your career. So finally, on the 36th ballot, the musical presents Hamilton as basically walking in and changing the election. It wasn't that dramatic. There were other factors. But nonetheless, Hamilton is a force in trying to break this tie. Now, the quandary for Hamilton is he has two opponents, Jefferson and Burr. So Hamilton's decision is the fire or the frying pan. And a lot of people believe that Hamilton will back Burr because Hamilton and Burr had once been close and then before they had a falling out, whereas Jefferson and Hamilton fought on everything. But Jefferson is picked by Hamilton. Hamilton throws his weight behind Jefferson. With Hamilton's weight behind, it entices enough other folks to go that way, and Jefferson wins the presidency. Burr becomes his vice president. So this is hugely controversial, and Hamilton would end up backing a person who was the polar opposite of him in terms of his ideology and his vision for the country. So this is a shocking moment in American history.
A shocking moment. And it becomes then that kind of defining relationship for the final 4 years of Alexander Hamilton's life, because Aaron Burr runs for the governorship, I think, of New York. He fails. Hamilton is opposed to him in that. And a bitterness is created, and there's animosity, and comments that Hamilton made are taken up by Burr, and he challenges him to a duel.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
It's the 10 Dual Commandments.
Number 1, the challenge demands satisfaction. If they apologize, no need for further action.
Number 2,
if they don't, grab a friend, that's your second.
Your lieutenant, when there's reckoning to be reckoned.
Number 3,
have your seconds meet face to face.
Negotiate a fee or negotiate a time and place.
This is commonplace, especially between recruits.
Most disputes die and no one shoots. Number 4,
if they don't reach a peace, that's alright. Time to get some pistols and the doctor on site.
You pay him in advance, you treat him with civility.
You have him turn around so he can have deniability.
5,
duel before the sun is in the sky.
Pick a place to die when it's high and dry. Number 6,
leave a note for your next of kin. Tell him where you've been. Pray that hell or heaven lets you in.
7,
confess your sins, ready for the moment of adrenaline. When you finally face your opponent.
Number 8,
chance to negotiate. Send in your second, see if they can set the record straight.
Alexander.
Aaron Burr, sir.
Can we agree the duels are dumb and immature?
Sure, but your man has to answer for his words, Burr.
With his life, we both know that's absurd, sir.
Hang on, how many men died because Lee was inexperienced and ruinous?
Okay, so we're doing this.
Number 9.
Look him in the eye, ain't no higher. Summon all the courage you require.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,
number
10, place is fire!
Yeah, the last 4 years are quite tragic. One of the things that, I guess, led to this was George Washington dies on December 14, 1799. If Washington was alive, Hamilton wouldn't have been in the crosshairs of so many people because Washington was so far above, I guess, everything and so well-respected. And Washington wouldn't have tolerated Hamilton dueling. I think it's also, it's one of those historical what-ifs that's hard to do, but I think it's reasonable to think Hamilton might not have dueled if Washington was still alive, and Washington would have frowned on it. Nonetheless, Hamilton gets involved in a variety of arguments. He and Burr disagree on a number of things politically. Burr's angry because Hamilton helps get him defeated as governor of New York. They're both, quite frankly, having affairs, and they're writing about it, and one thing leads to another, and Hamilton is challenged to a duel. Now, dueling at the time was beginning to fall out of favor, but it was still somewhat common, and a lot of duels ended where people didn't shoot one another. You would go to the quote-unquote field of honor, and you would have a second, and you would negotiate that you both either wouldn't fire or you would miss on purpose, and that way you had your honor, but you also had your life. Apparently, Byrd doesn't get the memo on this and shoots Hamilton, and we're still not 100% certain of the reasons surrounding it, but I think it's clear Burr wanted to be the hero of the war. Hamilton was the hero of the war. Burr wanted to be part of Washington's inside group, and he never was. It was Hamilton. Hamilton and Burr were both lawyers in New York, and Hamilton was in some ways a better lawyer. Burr was a very good lawyer. They fought over a number of things and then enter the issue of women and fidelity. So all this just comes to blows, and Hamilton is shot in Weehawken, New Jersey, in July of 1804, and dies soon thereafter. He doesn't live to see 50.
And yet, Grace, he did so much to create the modern United States that very much even the country today owes a huge amount in terms of the way it's structured, the way the economy is built, in terms of the foundations of the state.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, we've been talking a lot about this conflict between Jefferson and Hamilton, and they both kind of represent different sides of the United States and what it stands for as an idea. Because, you know, Americans think of the United States not just as a country, but as kind of this important sort of concept for what a country could look like. And I think, you know, they both have different ideas of what that country should look like that prevail in different ways. You know, Jefferson's got his idea of limited government, which is still very important, which he sort of overlaps with and shares with James Madison. He has an idea of the United States as being a place that's dominated by sort of rural, sort of agricultural farming, based economy, and that's still important, has been incredibly important in American history. Jefferson is very interested in Western expansion, he facilitates the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, and that's really important too. What does Hamilton stand for then in American history and sort of culture? He's kind of this driving sort of capitalist force. He's the guy who wants to make the United States a commercial power to rival the great sort of commercial powers of the Netherlands, of Great Britain, France. He's trying to facilitate that transformation. He's interested in building American cities. He's interested in facilitating American industry. You know, we're in this moment in the 1790s when Hamilton's career as a politician is really taking off, when obviously industrialization is kicking off in Europe as well. And so Hamilton wants to get a bit of that. And, you know, what happens to the United States? Well, it becomes sort of one of the most important industrial powers in world history. So, and that's all to some extent, you know, there are other people obviously who are involved in this, in these processes, and many people who follow all of this, who facilitate this. But Hamilton is one of the guys who's right there at the beginning, who's seeding some of these ideas, which are gonna transform the United States into what it is today.
Well, tonight we are talking about the life, legacy, and indeed the legend of Alexander Hamilton. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll explore that legacy, we'll explore the implications and the influence of the musical and what it really means to understand the United States and the role of Alexander Hamilton. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history as we explore the life, the death, and the legend of Alexander Hamilton. I'm rejoined by Professor Robert Watson of Lynn University in Florida and Dr. Grace Mallon, Career Development Fellow in History at Lady Margaret Hall at the University of Oxford. And Robert, I want to ask you about, I suppose, Hamilton today, because we do have the impact of the musical. Hamilton has this international reputation now that he certainly never had before. And I wonder, is it at the expense of Thomas Jefferson? Because Jefferson, his support of slavery, the fact that he had a relationship with an African-American woman and hid it, the fact that you have all of these issues and complications in Jefferson, I kind of think that his stock and his standing has been falling, and it has been then Alexander Hamilton who's been rising instead in his place.
No question about it. Yeah, Jefferson's reputation was sterling for so long. But recent scholarship has really been shining a light on the fact that he did have this affair. There's DNA testing to show that Sally Hemings is enslaved maid, and he had an affair. Also, Jefferson as a slave owner, Jefferson's contradictory, if not sometimes hypocritical personality. A lot of the recent scholarship has been fleshing this out, whereas on the other hand, Hamilton's legacy is rising. It doesn't hurt that Ron Chernow, the Pulitzer Prize winner, penned the book and, of course, the musical. And the musical does make Jefferson the foil for Hamilton in so many ways. And I guess you could say in the end analysis here, Hamilton seems to have won that feud. Whenever historians here in the U.S. meet, there's sort of a joke. A lot of folks say, okay, who do you like better, Hamilton or Jefferson? You know, and for years, I would always say Hamilton. Everybody would say Jefferson. Now you see that the numbers are kind of flipping. But Jefferson, with his vision for the country as a small agrarian community of, you know, small farmers and isolated from the world, versus Hamilton's very ambitious vision for the country with a strong government and international player. Hamilton's vision is the one that came true. So I guess in that respect, it makes some sense that Hamilton's star would be rising while Jefferson's not quite as much. In the year 2026, it'll be the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So that'll be a perfect time for everybody to reassess this. So I think that that trajectory will probably continue.
Grace, it kind of does show how much a musical can influence popular discourse and public discourse more than any history book, more than any history documentary, because the genius of Lin-Manuel Miranda has managed to do more for the reputation of Alexander Hamilton than centuries of scholarship.
That is a very good point. It's a little difficult to take as a historian, obviously, who's engaged in writing these books. But one of the great things about the musical and about a lot of the sort of popular culture surrounding the early American Republic is that historians do get a piece of the pie too. Historians, so I think, you know, the musical, the Hamilton musical, Lin-Manuel Miranda collaborated with a historian who's based at Yale University. Her name is Joanne Freeman, and she's one of the sort of foremost experts on Alexander Hamilton. And she's written, you know, academic history books about the American founding era. And she played a really important role in making that musical come to life. And her star has sort of risen also as a result, along with Lin-Manuel's and along with Alexander Hamilton's. So historians are getting a little bit of a piece of the pie.
And the Ron Chernow book as well.
Absolutely. And I think the point that Robert was making about, you know, mentioning the 250th anniversary is going to be this great moment where I hope we're going to see a lot more popular engagement, not just in the United States, but also around the world with the American founding era. I really want to see more film because I don't think there are enough movies about the American Revolution. So I'd love to see Hollywood engaging with it more. But Hamilton has been, and the Hamilton movie on Disney Plus have been a great start.
Robert, what do you think we still haven't really got right about Alexander Hamilton? What part of his life or what part of his character is there still kind of a confusion in the public mind about?
Well, I think historians have done a good job in fleshing out just how complicated he is, and or was rather. Whereas I think the public likes to portray things very simplistically, you know, unidimensionally. Hamilton was a complicated person. So many admirable traits, but a self-destructive side as well. And you can't but help. And as an historian, Grace would agree, you know, we hate to think, what would they do today? Nonetheless, everywhere I go, people ask me, what would they do today? Hamilton would not be good for today's polarized, you know, vitriol in our politics in the United States, because Hamilton was like that. He was abrasive. He was in your face. He didn't hold his fire. So I think that I like the musical. I love the musical. I'm a big fan of Hamilton's, always have been. The United States owes so much to Hamilton. His fingerprints are all over this country's history, and its influence continues today. But he was a very, very complicated and deeply flawed individual despite his brilliance.
I think that's a good way of summing up his life and indeed his legacy, and a good way to end our discussion tonight on the man, the myth and the musical that is Alexander Hamilton. My thanks to Professor Robert Watson, Distinguished Professor of American History at Lynn University in Florida, whose books include George Washington's Final Battle and Alexander Hamilton, Adultery and Apology, and Dr. Grace Mallon, who's the Career Development Fellow in History at Lady Margaret Hall at the University of Oxford. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.